Hello, and welcome to another episode of Yours Lawfully. This is a podcast brought to you by postgraduate law and tech students from Queen Mary University of London on behalf of the Technology, Media, and Telecommunications Law Institute. My name is Samantha, and today we have with us Nicola Carter, and she's going to talk a little bit about IT commercial law. So how about we start with an introduction of yourself?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Nicola. So I was born in London. I grew up in Essex with my parents. I now live in St Albans with my husband, and I have two children, 6 and 3 years old. I knew I always wanted to be a lawyer or work within the legal field. I even toyed with the idea of becoming a police officer at one stage. But I finally qualified as a solicitor in 2012. So I'm coming up to 11 years PQE now. I trained at Finer Stevens Innocent, which is now Howard Kennedy. I did a kind of usual training contract. So I did my commercial company corporacy and property, but I also had the experience of working in the IP and media seat with Mark Stevens, the renowned IP and media lawyer, and had the privilege of working on the Julian Assange case at the time in my training seat, which was really great experience. Since qualifying, I now work as an in-house counsel, and I've worked for two well-known data infrastructure and IT firms. Working my way up from newly qualified to now as a senior legal counsel for Europe.
Okay, well, that's amazing. A lot of stuff.
A lot of stuff, yeah.
Yeah. So what made you go into IT law? Like, how did you decide, yeah, this is where I want to go?
In all honesty, I fell into it. After my training contract, I did decide I wanted to be a company commercial corporate lawyer. But unfortunately, or should I say really fortunately, actually, the way it's worked out, I qualified during the period of the credit crunch. So my firm were not able to offer seats to many trainees. So I had to go about reevaluating what I kind of wanted to do. And I decided, you know, I loved being a lawyer and I loved commercial law and the deal negotiations, but without the necessary kind of aggressiveness of the litigation world. And I didn't really enjoy the long hours, if I'm really honest, working in for a private practice firm. So I started looking in-house. There seemed to be a better work-life balance there. And a few jobs came up in the tech sector at that time. You know, I was 24, 25. It seemed really cool and appealing, and opted for a job in a well-known data center provider, even though, if I'm honest, when I turned up for my interview, I didn't really know what a data center was or co-location. And then they started spinning out into networks and managed services and cloud, et cetera. And I found it really interesting, and to draft around those complexities, you know, you're starting a position of drafting something that you don't really know about and you have to go and learn about and talk to the technical teams. And I found it really interesting. So I moved to my current company in 2015, and they provide an even wider spectrum of technical services. They have a lot of different verticals. And, you know, one of our sister companies actually created the first emoji. So it was a really exciting opportunity to get involved in. So yeah, tech has been my world ever since.
Okay, wow, that little emoji thing, that's really interesting. It's amazing how everything like line up for you. So, you know, apart from being a lawyer, you're also a woman in STEM. So how is it like being a woman in STEM?
Do you know what? It is great. It is great. I love combining my interest in the law with my love of tech, or learning about tech, because as I say, I didn't really know much about it before I landed my first role. I've never really thought of myself as techie, but this world, I think, has changed in the last 10 years that I've been in the industry. When I first started, it was really unusual to see a woman in the office, you know, not just in the legal team, but in the technical teams, in the project management teams. And it was a bit of a cliquey boys club, if I'm honest, the first company I worked in. But as time has gone on, and in my current position, it's become, you know, much better. And there are women in all different types now. And there are so many more women, but also people from diverse ethnic backgrounds. You know, myself, I fall into both of those camps. I'm mixed, white and Asian. My mother's from Malaysia. So I noticed, you know, that there's so many more women in project management, technical architecture, and actually even in my legal team. So I sit at the European level. And we have but we have teams in every single EU country across the EU. And 6 out of 11 of those are headed up by women, which is fantastic. And on my legal team alone, there are 4 women and 1 man. So, you know, it's great. And you can see that that's progressing We did an International Women's Day the other day, and I could see from, you know, university applications, there were so many more women, a colossal increase in women taking part in computer science and engineering and mathematics. So I'm really proud. I'm still sometimes the only woman on a call of 10 men, but it's, you know, it's fantastic. And more work does need to be done. And recognizing unconscious bias is not enough to create, you know, an inclusive workforce. We need to put that into practical action.
Okay, that's amazing. As someone who's, you know, like a woman and an international student, it's nice to know that there's actually diversity, because you always hear about it, but you never actually know if it's like apply within the company.
My personal experience is definitely getting better.
Okay, that's nice. That's good to know. You also mentioned how you handle a lot the European Union. So how is it like to learn the law versus actually having to apply it?
So that's a bit of a tricky question. So we don't tend to come across, you know, kind of the international application of the law on a day-to-day basis, you know, save for elements of, I guess, GDPR. It all depends on the service scope of what we're providing. And it's usually governed, even on a kind of global basis, by the laws of the EU country in which the service is provided or where the client is based. But as you know, even in the EU, there are disparities between the law, and it's always a learning process. We can't be experts all of the time. The contract law basics, I would say, are similar, but, you know, each of the countries have their own civil codes, liability constraints. One example I came across the other day was that in Switzerland, for example, they don't allow you to carve out liability for willful default or gross negligence, whereas we would do that in the UK, and gross negligence isn't really a fully recognized concept. So it's always a case-by-case basis. And for most countries, we have in-house counsel, so I tend to go to them to seek their guidance, or we instruct, you know, external local counsel. Usually the deals that I do, the only tricky bit can sometimes be, because we sit at the EU level, I will tend to do multi-service tower deals across multi-countries. So it's then trying to, you know, marry up what's the kind of common denominator between those countries and what can everyone accept. But yes, it's always a learning experience. I don't think you ever fully learn, but that's great. Otherwise it would be boring, right? It's a continual learning experience.
Okay, that's also nice to know, because I feel like it's really intimidating to like start practicing, and it's nice to know that you constantly learn something every day.
Yeah.
Also, in our initial communications, you mentioned how you deal a lot with banks.
Yeah.
So how much finance and IT commercial law would you say it's involved in this? Do you think that people will be surprised about how much these two are connected?
Well, I mean, fundamentally, commercial law is commercial law. You know, it's just a broad term for a range of services that support businesses to make money from their products and services. What I would say about banks, and I'm not sure that people would be that heavily surprised, is that they are subject to an inordinate amount of scrutiny and regulation, which makes them notoriously difficult to contract with. As much as we want to assist our clients to achieve their compliance, we ourselves in the IT industry, for the most part, are not subject to those regulations. So, you know, we can only help them as far as we're practically able to do so. I'd say one of the most difficult things to comply with commercially with banks is the requirement for their continuity of service. So given that the service the bank provides, their financial regulators want to ensure that whatever happens, they get their continuity of service. There is no break in that chain. I think one of the good examples from kind of commercial law is the ability for termination. So the termination rights for a supplier in the IT industry for banks are very limited. And even when you are able to terminate for misuse or non-payment, et cetera, the client still needs an exit provision, which can sometimes mean you have to continue to provide services to them for, I don't know, 12, 18 months, which is hard for a supplier to stomach when they've not been paid, you know, for a bit before that. So I think conversely, the bank then requires the termination rights for every single event that you can imagine, for regulatory change, for a change of a material subcontractor, for convenience to alleviate any sort of concentration risk. So, you know, commercial law, I think, always plays a part, whatever industry you're negotiating with. But the requirements or expectations change. But you're right, banks are difficult, and it's not just the initial contracting period, it's the ongoing relationship too that you have to continually manage.
Okay. And so from all of the clients and banks that you have had to work with, which one has been the most exciting for you, or like the one that has impacted the way that you view IT commercial the most?
It was definitely a deal that I concluded in 2019. It was one of the largest deals that I've headed up to date, which was approximately £40 million. And it was for a large banking client. And the bank engaged a well-known international law firm to negotiate on their behalf. I was a good few years qualified, but it's still quite intimidating, you know, when you sit across from a table of a partner, an associate, a bunch of trainees, their in-house counsel. And there was just me, because we have quite a small in-house legal team. And it's quite difficult, you know, but it's also something that really shapes your career when you're having to be involved in that. I think as much as you hate to admit it at the time, it's really important that you allow yourself to learn from other lawyers, especially senior lawyers. Even at the time you're negotiating a completely different point, you know, you're arguing against them. But it was a really great deal. You know, we were sat in their offices for an entire month, you know, every single day, negotiating the practical service scope work, hashing out the commercials, the legals. And you have to train your brain to constantly question everything, the way things are drafted, how a scenario would work out in practice. You have to have a sense of curiosity. There's no point arguing and agreeing a contract that's merely about lawyers winning points, which tends to be the case sometimes when you go up against private practice lawyers, because obviously that's what they're being paid for. But you need to ensure that the contract works for both parties. You know, very clever drafting doesn't always work for everyone. There was an example about, we were negotiating service levels and service credits, which is very common in the tech world. And they drafted a position that meant that we couldn't ever attain a service level. And clearly that doesn't provide a meaningful mechanism for either party to measure performance. I certainly learned a lot in this deal. I think it grew my confidence. It grew, you know, just my legal understanding of certain issues that before I'd only very scratched the surface off, you know, just to be able to negotiate at a very high level. But it was great. And having a deal team, working in-house and having a deal team is really fun experience, actually.
Okay, that's amazing. Thank you so much for that example. Now, moving on a little bit in relation to big changes, you already mentioned that you come from an IT company, and we know how COVID made everyone move from face-to-face things to technology. So how much would you say COVID affected the way that you deal with the application of IT commercial law, or like the way that you as a business had to adapt to COVID?
So I'd say in terms of application of commercial IT law, it didn't change fundamentally, except that I'd have to say, you know, we had to revisit and strengthen some of our provisions in our general framework agreement to deal with COVID and the subsequent fallout. So, for example, we had to look at force majeure provisions to include COVID and pandemics generally. And we had to focus on a way to deal with our issues in our supply chain, because, you know, the supply of materials and components when you're dealing with technology was really affected. And it's been one of our biggest issues post-COVID. Given the effects of the economy as well, we had to include some foreign exchange type clauses and the right to amend pricing in line with inflation. One of the kind of practical issues, I guess, as well is the acceptance of electronic signatures. So pre-COVID, I worked for a Japanese company as well, and especially in Asia, it was still very much the traditional use of wet ink signatures. Whereas post-COVID, because obviously everybody couldn't get in the same room to sign documents, electronic signatures became more prevalent, which is great. It makes life a lot easier. Mm-hmm. In terms of how the company had to adapt, I mean, clearly working from home was a huge adaption. It's been a real silver lining for me as a working mum, because I remember back in 2016 when I had my first child, working from home in my company wasn't really a thing. It was very rare. And I remember I went on flexible working and asked for a couple of days, you know, to work from home just to be available to pick up my daughter from nursery. and not my team, my team were fantastic, but there were other comments, you know, within the company as to there was a lot of working from home, you know, it wasn't the accepted norm. So now it's fantastic. And the company's really adapted.
Yeah, that's the new normal now, working from home.
Yeah. And the other thing I would say, I guess, is if, given that we're a technology company, COVID allowed us to adapt using different types of technology to now enable us to continue working. So, for example, Teams, like we're using right now, wasn't something we'd used before. And that's become our daily way of doing business now. We're also looking into certain AI technologies to make us more efficient. And I think all of that has come about, you know, post COVID, and how we can make our working life balance better.
So moving on a little bit from that, but also still with big changes, do you as an IT commercial lawyer feel like you always have to be on your toes to see how the technology change? Because, you know, if technology changes, the law can also change.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's a bit of a minefield at times, actually. And it isn't just because the technology itself is evolving, but I think the law around the use or the provision of certain types of technology is constantly changing. There's always something on the horizon. And I mean, it's not even always about technology. You know, you've got the GDPR and sustainability, but it can also be industry specific too. So, you know, we discussed earlier my role with specializing in the financial sector. We had to help a lot of clients with the European banking regulations, but we're not subject to that. They don't apply to us. So there's always room for negotiation. However, there's the new Digital Operational Resilience Act, which is also known as DORA, which entered into force in January of this year. And that's going to introduce a new framework that focuses on embedding a more robust and resilient approach to delivering digital capability in financial markets. So, you know, critical IT service providers can no longer just negotiate their way out of an issue that they don't particularly like. They're going to need to ensure that they can comply with the additional cybersecurity and resilience requirements, or they won't be able to play in that field. There's loads of other things as well that are always coming up that are just on the periphery. So, for example, there's a new AI white paper out about the proposals for AI regulation. And even before when I mentioned GDPR, you know, we're still waiting to see whether the government will replace the UK GDPR via the Data Protection and Digital Information Bill that's going to come to fruition this year. So, as I say, it's not always about the technology, but always, you know, the laws that have a bearing on the technology industry. Luckily, we also have great external counsel. You know, when you work in house, I said before, you can't always be, you know, the expert in every single area, and you have to lean heavily on people that are. And they keep on top of a lot of this for us and send us, you know, monthly updates. Otherwise, we'd be lost. We'd be spending all of our time looking at what's coming.
That's really nice, Molly. Then you can also have like counsel to guide you.
It's great.
So you deal with IT commercial law almost every day. We can mm-hmm. say that. So how important would you say is it in the law? Like, do you think that it's actually necessary, or is it not necessary to have it?
Oh, I would say it's absolutely vital. I mean, the commercial legal system, it provides a degree of certainty and it facilitates the commerce by providing, you know, procedures for enforcing the agreements between commercial parties. I don't think that just includes, you know, just agreeing an agreement up front and actually allowing the parties to do business. But it also, you know, that agreement will refer to how you handle a dispute, which jurisdiction, which courts. It's kind of a key or a map that allow both parties to know what is going to govern their relationship. In my experience, I mean, in my 10 years, I've only ever come across maybe 3 or 4 large commercial contractual disputes, you know, that go beyond the realms of just non-payment. And they were really where there weren't sufficient commercial provisions. You know, it's the old adage of prevention is always better than the cure. But I also think it's really important to go beyond just the norm of commercial law, you know, the basics. You need to really focus on what is being provided. And as I said before, from my example, when I negotiated that big deal, it isn't about winning legal points. It's about really establishing what those parties intend to achieve, especially service scope in a technical world, because it can get really tricky and you need to ensure that something isn't omitted. But it's also important from a risk allocation perspective, you know, service levels, liability. The biggest disputes have really stemmed from where there's ambiguous language or omissions. So I think it's absolutely vital.
Okay, that's amazing. Perfect. Thank you. Also, is there anything else that you would like to share or add?
Nothing major. I would just say, you know, I know this is going out to probably your university colleagues, isn't it? And I would really recommend working in the technology industry, whether it's legal or otherwise. You come across many of the same pure legal issues as you would doing as a commercial lawyer in any other field or industry. But because the technology is constantly evolving, there are kind of boundless opportunities to learn, but also to create a niche for yourself. You know, I know now in this field that I've been working in that there aren't many lawyers that know about data infrastructure. So you can really create a little home for yourself and a name for yourself if you really want to. But it also means that you're constantly involved in something where you can continually learn, because I think that's also really important.
Well, I think that's an amazing advice for everyone out there that is struggling to decide they should go into the technology industry or not, especially the law field. So I really hope that this episode showed you a little bit about how it actually works. And I would also like to thank Nicola for being with us today and sharing all of this amazing and insightful details about IT commercial law. And I really hope that you as a listener like the episode. Don't forget to subscribe and share it, and see you next time. Ciao.